All right, we're going to complete our study on Lecture X this evening, and what I'm going to attempt to do is just try and give a highlight. Obviously, I'm not going to touch every point that he touched, but try and give a summary or a brief synopsis of the essence of his argument with respect to the law is king. When he began his study, Radovitz said that what is warranted by the direction of nature's light is warranted by the law of nature, and consequently by a divine law. For who can deny the law of nature to be a divine law? Okay, so if you're reading older books, many times you'll come across this, the law of nature, the law of nations. So Radovitz at the beginning sets out and he says, let me give you my understanding, because he uses this term throughout his book, the law of nature. And he says, the law of nature is nothing other than God's law reflected in nature. Obviously, the highest authority is God's law, but when we are confronted with the world that God has created, we need to expect to see the same manifestation of Him in the world with respect to the laws that are naturally perceived, as we will find in His revealed law. They're not going to conflict with each other. And if they is conflict in what we think we're seeing in nature and what God's law says, we've got to realize we're misunderstanding the law of nature, because God's law and laws of nature should complement one another. The U.S. Constitution in 1810 says the Congress is to punish offenses against the law of nations. So they use that term, the law of nations. The founding fathers, following Grotius and Vattel, defined the law of nations as an extension of God's unchanging law revealed through nature, that is, reflecting himself and observable to all peoples. The existence of such a universal law points to the transcendent authority of the one and only Lord, creator of the universe. The law of nature and the law of nations are reflections of, and therefore subject to, the supreme law of God that has been revealed to man and preserved as scripture. So when you're reading our Constitution and understanding the foundation of our nation, and they're appealing to the law of nations, they're not disagreeing with God's law. They're saying that is obvious. It's something that is obvious to us. It's obvious to these other Christian nations that we're in communication with, and we expect to hold each other accountable to that standard, which we presume is obvious. Okay, and that's a very important biblical principle. As Romans 1 talks about the inescapable revelation of God in creation. And so we have to presume, and Rutherford, this is a big point in Rutherford's understanding and application of the law, is the perspicuity of the truth of the law of God, meaning it's clear, you can see it. It is not something that is obscure, it is not something that is hidden. It's clear and obvious, and that's an important starting point in Rutherford's argument. Rutherford said that civil government was not an invention of man, but rather was warranted by divine law. There are people that say civil government was men just decided to have it and that's why we've got it. And rather this is no, this is from the beginning, this is God's divine law. He said all civil power is immediately from God in its root. Okay, you can support that by obviously Romans, all authority is ordained of God, but in its root. And Rutherford backed this up by saying that God made man a social creature and inclined to being governed by man. Thus, this power to govern must be in man's nature. Rutherford also said that God and nature intended for there to be order and peace in the affairs of mankind. Therefore, God and nature have given to mankind a power to secure this end, which necessitates the power of government. Okay, so we're social creatures. God intended us to live in communities. He intended us to manifest justice and truth and integrity in communities. Now we're in a sinful world. Now what are we going to do? We can pretend that sin doesn't exist and we can try and define a utopia, but we can't do that. That's unrealistic. And so basically the mere fact that God intended us to function as people to serve and to manifest justice, it's inescapable that he intended civil government to be there. And if he intended civil government to be there, he intended people to have the authority to institute and set up civil government. So it's God's design from the beginning in order to bring about the protection and the prosperity and the peace of people. Rather, it says, kings and magistrates are gods, and God's deputies and lieutenants upon the earth. And he has a number of passages he quotes, Psalm 82, 1, and verses 6 and 7, Exodus 22, 8, and 4:16. So he says, so they are God's lieutenants. That's their only calling. That's their only responsibility. A political official is a lieutenant of God, and therefore their office must be a lawful ordinance of God. Okay, if you're going to serve me, God says, you're going to serve me and my kingdom, you've got to assume, you've got to presume, okay, well, surely this is a lawfully instituted office that God ordained. Okay, so I don't think he's arguing out of silence. I don't think he's forcing anything. I think he's just showing us that not every question we want answered is answered in the same way. Sometimes we want a proof text that spells it out. And it, not everything's answered. You know, every time your car has a problem, you don't fix the problem in the same way. I want an answer to this. Well, there's different ways to answer the thing. And the scriptures give us that ability to understand these things. By what it expects of us, we can say, well, indeed, it expects us to live in justice with one another. What does that look like? Who's to enforce when there's injustice? Who's to be the determiner? How do we set this up so it's not a law unto yourselves? So all that, in Rutherford's mind, establishes the fact that God intended and is instituted from the beginning. He is the source of civil authority. So Rutherford established that the kingly office itself is from God. However, he also said that it also flows from the people. So God made the office, but there's the people have a vital component to play in the whole establishment of civil government. What Rutherford means by this office flowing from the people is not its formal institution. The people didn't decide. The people didn't, by an act of reason, devise this office on their own. What Rutherford means by that is that God instituted the office and the people only choose the person to fill the office and what kind of civil structure they will have, the kind of actual, is it going to be a monarchy, is it going to be a republic, is it going to be an aristocracy? Whichever one they choose, they are still bound by the laws of justice that God has established, and the leaders that they put in place are bound by those same laws. So whatever structure you know, he says there's liberty for different societies to choose different structures, and there's liberty for them to choose different people to fill those structures. But the structure is ordained by God, and what has to happen and how that structure is to administer everything is ordained by God. And so everything in that sense is equal across the board, across nations. Fundamental to Rutherford's understanding of civil authority are these three things. That the authority granted to civil rulers is measured out in small, exact quantities. Measured out by whom? By the people. They measure out. We say, we want you to govern us. We want you to govern us in this way. And so they measure out the authority. And so into that office they impute that authority to govern. Obviously God's law is there, but the people are actually giving a commission to the religious leaders, and they measure it out. And that's important. That's a good term to remember. It's measured out in quantities. And therefore, the civil authority is not allowed to do more than what has been measured out to him, and he's not allowed to do less than what has been measured out to him. Rutherford said, secondly, this is done in order to limit, moderate, set banks on, and reveal the responsibilities. That's why they do it. Why am I giving you this authority, sir? I'm giving you this authority so that you can do X, Y, and Z in order to bring about justice and peace and protection. And so I'm giving you that authority to accomplish that. And thirdly, that this authority is given out conditionally. And therefore the people may take back the authority if the conditions are violated. It's not just a blank check. It's not just a, well, once I've given it, it's irretrievable. No, measured quantities to set the parameters conditionally that you fulfill the conditions and the parameters. If you violate those, I withdraw my consent and I take back that authority. And Rutherford points to both sides, saying, the magistrate is to judge by a known statute and law. The community's law is the law of nature, not their arbitrary lust. Okay, we know what the law of nature is. It's the law of God. And so he's saying, the magistrate judge by known statutes, the laws that have been established, and the people are to establish those laws in terms of not their lusts. I want you to give me... It's the laws that they establish for the magistrate to govern by are God's laws, the laws of nature, not their own lusts and desires. So both the magistrate and the people are bound by God's law. Rather, but certainly, whoever makes a covenant with the people, promising to govern them according to God's word, and upon condition and these terms received a throne. So he promised to govern that. On the condition of promising to govern in a certain way, he received a throne and a crown, or he received the White House seat. Whatever it is, it was on conditions of certain established things. So on condition that he agreed to those terms, he received the throne and the crown from the people. And because of this, he is obliged to carry out what he promised to the people. Whosoever makes a promise to another gives to the other a sort of right or jurisdiction to challenge the promise. That is, to make sure it's being met. If you give me your promise, you give me a right to challenge to see if your promise is being kept. And so when the king says, I promise, when the president puts up his hand and he says, and I swear, and he's going to judge and rule and uphold the Constitution of this United States, he's swearing that, the people have every right and absolutely a responsibility to hold him accountable to that pledge. And he needs to be held accountable to that pledge. That's the basis of him receiving the office. Rutherford says, even if the people have no written or verbal covenant or agreement with the king with respect to respective responsibilities, this doesn't give anyone license to do whatever they desire. He says, if there is no condition betwixt a Christian king and his people, then those things which are just and right according to the law of God are understood to rule both king and people as if they had been written. Okay, there's no escaping this. Because you have a bunch of ignorant people and the king gets into power and he's not loosed from all restraints because the people were ignorant about what laws to make. He says, no, you're still under God. The office is always and only according to law. Rather, it says that it is unlawful for the king to take an oath that does not include him swearing to govern the people according to law. It's unlawful for a king to say, I'm going to take an oath and I don't swear to uphold the Constitution, uphold the agreements, the laws that you people are laying before me. God's law is always first, but any constitution is also included in Rutherford's thinking, the laws of the people. Obviously, the Constitution itself needs to be bound by the law of God as well. It is the law that makes the office, and not the office that makes the law. You see, that's the whole argument of the Lex Rex. It was the office, the king, made the law. And Rutherford says, no, it is always the law that makes the office. And it is God's law that starts off, sets up the office. The laws that are to be given, the authority that's given to that office are according to law. And so the office flows out of the law and is subject to the law. So it's the law that makes the office, and not office that makes the law. And so that authority and submission always has to be according to that. And even the office on the human level of the civil authority is made by law, and it is maintained by law. So it continues in its existence in terms of law. As soon as it violates law, it violates its own authority, it violates its office, destroys itself. Congress doesn't give birth to... Does Congress give birth to law? Shouldn't. I know they're doing it at the moment. They're being a law unto themselves. They're not subject to the Constitution. Congress can only make laws in terms of the Constitution. And then the check on them is what? Well, you've got the executive who's a check on them. If he's a good president, he's checking on them and saying, well, I'm going to veto this. But let's say he's also corrupt like Congress, then where's the check? The Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court then saying, no, these laws and these rulings, these things are in violation of the Constitution. They are illegal. They have no authority. But when the Supreme Court goes fraught, no, what? Are the people just helpless? Of course not. The people are the final voice, saying, no, the law is perspicuous. It's clear. Rather, it says, but that God has given no absolute and unlimited power to a king above law is evident by this. He who in his first institution is appointed by God to office, even when he sitteth on the throne, is told to take heed to read a written copy of God's law, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and to keep all of his words and all of his laws. He is not of absolute power above law. Deuteronomy 17, verses 18 and 19. Rather, it says, this is clear. When God commanded the king, when you're sitting in your office, you read the law. and you make your laws in subjection to that. If the king uses tyrannical power against the people for their hurt and destruction, he uses the power that the people never gave him, and against the intention of nature. For they invested man with power to be their father and defender for their good. And he faileth against the people's intention in usurping or an overpower to himself in granting himself more power than he should, which they never gave, they never had, and they never could give. So when the king takes an authority to himself that he's going to now destroy the nation, he didn't take that from the people. They never gave him that authority. Rather, they never could give him that authority. It was never theirs to give. They don't have we don't have an authority to tell a king to do anything he wants. We can't make him say, well, we'd like you to destroy our nation. Because God has not given us that authority to do that. God's law is still the ultimate authority, and people are not given that authority to destroy themselves. And so the law that the people have given to the king is so that he might serve them. And they cannot give what they never had, because the power to destroy themselves they never had, Rutherford argues. So Rutherford says, when the magistrate does anything by violence and without law, insofar doing against his office, he is not a magistrate. Then say I, that power by which he doth is not of God. None doth then resist the ordinance of God who resists the king in tyrannous acts. A king can act as a man or as a king. Okay, so he's saying you've got a man who's serving as a king, and you've got to realize that he can act in two capacities. He can act as a man, or he can act as a king. When he acts as a man, he's acting contrary to his office. When he acts as a king, he's acting in accordance with his office. And so the same person can act as a king and he can act as a man, depending on how he is applying the law, how he is fulfilling his responsibilities. And when he acts contrary to law, he's acting merely as a man. This holds true of all the actions of the king as king. The king as king can do no more than that which upon right and law he may do. He can't do anything more than the law has given him authority to do. Rutherford says, the prince is the minister of God for good of the subject, okay? And therefore, the law says he cannot pardon and free the guilty of the punishment due him. And the reason is clear. He is but the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that does evil. And if the judgment be the Lord's, not man's, not the king's, as it is indeed, he cannot draw the sword against the innocent, nor absolve the guilty. Okay, so he's quoting there from Deuteronomy 1:17 and 2 Chronicles 19:6. So, because he's bound by that, you can't release the death sentence for somebody who deserves the death sentence. For Rutherford, what makes a law a law? This does. When it has its source in perfection. Thus, not all laws deserve the name law, because a law which deserves the name law cannot lie. It has to be perfect. It has to be in accordance with God's truth. Otherwise, we cannot call it a law. Now, we can call it a law. There's many laws in our nation that you know, if we don't obey them, we're going to get prosecuted. But what makes a law, in God's sense, from God's perspective, and that is when it's in line with God's truth. So a law cannot lie, because who is the father of lies? Satan is the father of lies, and any lie does not deserve to be called a law. So whatever is not in conformity to God's truth is a lie. The system in Scotland, they had three estates, which were kind of like elected representatives, and they kept a check on the king. They kind of made up the parliament. The estates were a check on the king, and Rutherford said that the ultimate check upon the estates was the people. He said, and I quote him, by the people and the conscience of the people, they are to be judged. So the estates were accountable there. So if the king's out of line, the estates were meant to pull them into line. If the king and the estates are out of line, the people have a right and a responsibility to judge. Their conscience is able to do that. Why? Because of what? The perspicuity of the law. It's a vital point in Rutherford's thinking. You can disagree with that and you could say, I find fault with that. But what we're trying to understand here is Rutherford's thinking. Rutherford defined a tyrant as someone who habitually sins against the Catholic, meaning the universal, against the universal good of the subjects and states and subverts law. That's what a tyrant is. He habitually sins against the people, the nation, and he subverts law. If the office of a tyrant, so to speak, be contrary to a king's office, it is not from God, and so neither is the power from God. Yea, laws, when they are begin to be hurtful, they leave off to be laws. So when laws are destroying, they are no longer laws. In Rutherford's mind, no longer laws in God's mind, according to Rutherford's argument. Rutherford's opponents rested upon the fact that the meaning of a law was open to debate, and so to bring an end to this debate, his opponents argued, we need a final voice, and that final voice is the king. You know, we can have all these arguments and debates, and it was never going to be settled, therefore let's have the king, and his word is final, and that settles everything. And Rutherford's answer to this was to stand upon the presupposition of the perspicuity of Scripture, and the perspicuity of fundamental law, that these are self-evident and clear. Rutherford said, as the Scriptures in all fundamentals are clear, and expone themselves, interpret themselves, and condemn heresies, so all laws of men in their fundamentals, which are the law of nature and of nations, are clear. So for Rutherford, this is a fundamental presupposition. That's our starting point. That's where we start our thinking, the perspicuity of truth. Rutherford taught that the law had one fundamental rule, namely the safety of the people. He said, whatever interpretation swerves either from the fundamental laws of policy or from the law of nature and the laws of nation, and especially from the safety of the public, is to be rejected as perverting the law. And therefore, the natural conscience of all men, to which the oppressed people may appeal unto when the king exponeth a law unjustly. So when the king's interpreting a law unjustly, people may appeal to the conscience of man. He says that is the last rule on earth for exponing of laws, interpreting laws. Nor ought laws to be made so obscure. Okay, this is important. Laws must not be made so obscure as an ordinary wit, ordinary person, cannot see their connection with fundamental truths of policy and the safety of the people, and therefore I see no inconvenience to say that the law itself is the rule and the directory to square the judge, and that the judge is the public practical interpreter of the law. Okay, so basically what he's saying is, if the laws are so obscure, which is what we had to have in our day, where you've got this legalese, they call it, the laws they make so complicated to understand that the average person reading it doesn't know what it says. He says that's the motive behind that is in order to be corrupt. It's in order to distort and pervert law, is to make it so convoluted that nobody can really understand it. And you can read anything into it and out of it, as our Supreme Court has just done. They can see anything inside that law. Oh, well, we can even, our Chief Justice says, you can even try and imagine what you think possibly the legislators were trying to say. Even if they worded it in such a perverse way that you can't really understand it and it's unclear, we must try and think, what were they trying to say? I mean, you show me how that's a basis for any kind of appeal, any kind of law. Rutherford said, no rational man can create assents to a law contrary to the law, because the true meaning of a law is the essential form of the law. It must follow that there can be no necessity of written laws to the subjects against Scripture and natural reason and the law of nations, in which all accord. They're all in agreement. It can be nothing that contradicts that. That laws are not promulgated and published. Sorry, laws that are not promulgated and published cannot oblige as law. They cannot serve as laws. You can't just suddenly have this law appearing on the in the scene and say, where'd this come from? This was never made known. But if the king's absolute will may put on the law what sense it pleases, out of its independent and irresistible supremacy, the laws promulgated and written to the subjects can declare nothing. What is to be done by the subjects is just, and what is to be avoided as unjust. Because the laws must signify to the subjects what is just and what is unjust, according to their genuine sense. Now their genuine sense, according to royalists, is not only uncertain and impossible to be known, but also contradictory. So the general sense and the intent of the law, nobody can understand. In fact, the laws all contradict themselves, and so we can't hope to have any kind of justice where there's a consistent application of law. So our solution is what? Let's just give the king absolute authority. Brother says, if the king as king may alter any one wholesome law, by the same reason he may alter all of them. If a king, when violating wholesome laws, retains the full authority of a king. Okay, so when a king's meddling with the law, if at that point he retains the full authority of a king, which means, it means he still has God's full backing. That's rather his argument. He still has God's full backing. If he can play with the laws and still be the king, which is what Rutherford's opponents said he is, he still has, then Rutherford says, so what you're saying to me is that no matter if he's violating these laws, he still has God's full backing supporting him. Rutherford says, if that's the case, then the office trumps law, and so the whole thing reverses back to Rex Lex, the king is law. Whereas the title of his book tells you his argument, the law is king, Lex Rex. Rutherford said, people do not realize how quickly a so-called transient violation. So here we have the king making this little violation. He says that people do not realize how quickly a so-called transient violation of law can permanently change everything in the nation. Give me an example. Contemporary example. Immigration. We're not enforcing. We're not enforcing immigration policies. You've changed the nation. You've changed the mindset. You've changed the demographics. You've changed the flow. You've changed the direction of the nation. You see, because people fail to realize why you have structures, why you have voting rights and who you give those rights to. Because why don't we just open our borders up to China and say any Chinese people, however many billion you want to send, we welcome them with open arms, we'll give them voting rights in the forthcoming elections. Where are we going to end up? People have this romantic view about all those nations where the people are struggling to get into the United States. Why are they doing that? Because their own philosophy has failed. Their own belief structure has failed. Their own cultures have become disastrous in many respects, and they want out. They want to come where there has been, at least historically, liberty and justice and a foundation where law protects property so that you can advance yourself. You can go forward and make a prosperous life for yourself and your families. Where wealth doesn't evaporate. It's not stolen. Your property has meaning. And so the transient refusal to enforce immigration policies has changed this nation. It's changed it. I don't know how you reverse that. And so rather than saying, yeah, well, we thought it's a small thing. No, that's tyranny. Those actions were tyrannical. And if people were astute and understood the real issues, they would have recognized those actions at the beginning and would have risen up in absolute outcry and said, this is madness. That power, Rutherford says, this, meaning the civil magistrate, that power which is obliged to command and rule justly and religiously for the good of the subject, and is only set over the people on these conditions, and not absolutely, okay, set over in conditions, cannot tie the people to subjection without resistance when the power is abused to the destruction of laws, religion, and subjects. So, the power that is subject to law, that's what his condition of his authority, that's what he's given authority to rule by. Those are the conditions. It's not absolute. We've measured it out to you. That authority cannot say to the people, you are not allowed to resist me when I in turn my destructive powers upon the nation's laws, upon the religion, and upon the people. You're saying I can't resist you? On what basis? Obviously you can, based on law. You can't make a law that is contrary to established law. You can't make a law that's contrary to that. The Constitution is established law, the highest authority in this nation. No law has any legal binding that is contrary to the Constitution. Has no authority whatsoever. Nothing is morally binding that is contrary to established law. This includes both biblical and constitutional law. Nothing is morally binding. Morally binding from God's perspective. You might be forced, you can be manipulated, you can be intimidated, you can be cajoled into submitting to a law that they're calling a law. But that doesn't mean it's a moral law before God. It doesn't mean you have moral obligation before God to obey that because some authority is telling you to do such and such. Rutherford said, it is evident from Romans 13 that all subjection and obedience to higher powers commanded there is subjection to the power and office of the magistrate. That is, to the person using the power lawfully. It's subjection to the office, not to the person. Obey those in authority over you is subjection to the established office that God has established. That's what we're doing. And so therefore, the established office, when it is maintaining law, upholding law, and advancing law, is the authority of God. And we bow to it. So he's saying, to the person using the power lawfully, and that no subjection is due by that text, or any word of God, to the abused and tyrannical power of the king, which I evince from this text and from other scriptures. So Romans 13 is not commanding us to obey any command that comes from an official's mouth. He's saying that's not. It's absolutely no way. That's rather his position. You might disagree, and you're welcome to argue the point. But he says there's no word of God anywhere that grants to that position obedience to a law that's unlawful in accordance with God's truth. To Rutherford's mind, it's impossible to interpret Romans 13 any way other than a person administering his office lawfully, meaning in accordance with God's law. He says, essential to tyranny is to command and rule by violence. However, he qualifies this by saying, if a lawful prince do one or more acts of tyranny, he is not a tyrant for that, yet his action in that is tyrannical, and he does not that as a king. So if a king or a leader does something wrong, he doesn't immediately get removed from office. But the thing that he was doing wrong is tyrannical. It is wrong. And it is not binding. And I'm not bound to obey him there while I'm obeying him in these 999 other places. There you're wrong. So I'm not throwing off your authority because you did something wrong. So he's saying when he acts contrary to law, he's acting as a sinful man, having something of tyranny in him. And so there's no ways that Rutherford brings his mind into thinking, well, I've got to obey this lawful prince in his isolated acts of tyranny. Do I need to obey isolated acts of tyranny? No. Do I need to obey my lawful prince? Yes. Rutherford continues saying, he that resists the power, that is the official power, and the king as king, when the king is king and commanding in the Lord, then you are resisting the ordinance of God, as Romans 13 talks about. And you're resisting God's lawful constitution. But he who resists the man who's the king, but he's commanding that which is against God, and he's killing innocents, resists no ordinance of God, but an ordinance of sin and Satan. For a man commanding unjustly and ruling tyrannically hath in that no power from God. To illustrate this, Rutherford said, subjection is due to Nero as an emperor, but not any subjection is due to him in the burning of Rome, the torturing of Christians, unless you're going to say Nero's power abused in these acts of cruelty was a power from God, an ordinance of God, and that in this he was the minister of God for good to the commonwealth. They're saying that's what you've got to conclude. If you're saying those acts were lawful, or because it was his office, we can't resist it. You say, okay, because that was the power of God acting in him. So obviously, rather than saying it's not, when he acts as a tyrant, it's not the authority of God. He's not acting as the minister of God for good for the people. Rutherford then explains why Paul gave this teaching. Romans 13, it confuses people because he's just come out of chapter 12 and he goes into 13 and then he goes back to 14, and it seems like this kind of synopsis of civil government is thrown in the middle of nothing. It's something different. It's kind of out of place. He says, Paul gave this teaching here because some believed Christians were free from the yoke of magistracy. Okay, so once you became a Christian was an understanding. We no longer need government. We got Christ as our king. We don't need governments. We don't need civil rulers. And he's saying, no, Paul needed to correct that, this wrong thinking in people's minds. They're thinking that they're free from the yoke of magistracy and that the dignity itself, the exalted position, was unlawful. We cannot exalt people to these positions because Christ is our king. And so Christians were confused as to what the civil realm looked like. It was almost like pietism removed from the dusty details of life because we don't need these things. And you've still got many Christians who act in that kind of way where we don't need civil authorities, we don't need police, we don't need military, we don't need those things. Once again, creating a world that's a fantasy. It's not God's world. So it was because of that wrong understanding that Paul introduced Romans 13 at this point. And because in chapter 12 he had set down the lawful church rulers, and in this and the following chapter, chapter 14, the duties of brotherly love one towards another. So here in chapter 13 he teaches that all magistrates, including heathens, are to be obeyed and submitted unto in all things so far as they are ministers of God. That's what the whole thing. We can base this whole argument on the fifth commandment. Children, obey your parents. And as Paul brings that out, what does he say? Children, obey your parents. Who can finish it for me? In the Lord. What is he saying? Those who are walking in submission to God's truth. Not anything that comes into their mind. Not any sin. There's no obedience commanded by God for that. And the civil magistrate flows out of that. The civil magistrate rests upon that commandment of children obeying their parents in the Lord. So it's like a secondary thing to that. That's the more important one. The fifth commandment is more important, and this one is a subset of that. Rutherford says that when you resist a person in authority, you are resisting a person who remains clothed with lawful habitual power, yet you are resisting certain acts or commands that are flowing from an abused power. So there's this person in authority that you're resisting. He's got this authority, it continues, but the aspect that you're resisting is the abused power that's coming from that office. He says, the authority has all its power by law, not from the man's person. The person is to be honored for the authority, not the authority for the person. You can't make a law that is contrary to established law. Nothing is morally binding that is contrary to established law. And if I have to try and not give a complete précis, but to try and give you a couple of sentences that summarize some of the pertinent points to help you get your mind around Rutherford's argument, it will be this. The people, when granting conditional authority to the civil magistrate for their own good, are presupposing the perspicuity of law. That is, that they know exactly what they are granting to the magistrate, and that they will recognize exactly when he is violating what they have granted him. If he violates their trust, he has no authority in that violation, and so they have no moral obligation to obey it. Moreover, resisting the magistrate in that violation is not resisting the authority of God. That, to my mind, sums up how Rutherford understands the responsibility and the issue. It's based on the presupposition of the perspicuity of law, and that the people who are granting that law to the magistrate in the first place understand exactly what they are giving him. It's clear in their minds. It's not, I'm not sure what we gave the guy, let's hope it works out well. And once they've granted it to him, and they've granted to him self-consciously understanding the law, they will know when he violates the very thing that they granted him. Otherwise, they don't know what they granted him. If you don't know what you granted him, then you're not going to know when he violated it. If you don't know when he violated, then you don't even know what justice is. But if we are called to walk in justice, then we have to presuppose the perspicuity of law, and we have to hold that and stand upon it and not budge our ground from that. And say, ultimately, the final judge of the law is the conscience of man, the individual. And we want leaders. We need leaders to serve us and protect us. But when they don't, Rutherford does have an answer to that.